I want to start out by saying this word kill has been with me for several weeks, knowing that I would be giving a talk with it as central word. And I've given some other talks about this precept, and I've heard many talks, and I know that I've probably done it, and I've probably heard a lot of them about not killing animals and not killing plants to eat. But I have not been able to get out of my mind for weeks now the Roberta Flack song that was popular in the 1970s that has the words, strumming my pain with his fingers, singing my life with his words, killing me softly with his song, killing me softly with his words. And I decided that I really wanted to talk about killing with words, killing with what we say, not on purpose, but out of habit, out of sometimes unconscious pain, and sometimes just thinking that we're funny or trying to hide some kind of worry that we have about ourselves. Such a frequently used word in our language. Trying to think of some of the obvious phrases we use, like, we're just killing time. Or I heard myself say, even this morning, to somebody, that just kills me when it happens. Or when I feel like something has really killed my enthusiasm. Or at times when we dress to kill. Or we think we've really aced something or done it really well. I know I hear more with younger people saying, I really killed it. But then we kill our dreams and we kill all vulnerable beginnings, which my friend Irene Borger taught me from a beautiful creative class that she gives. I think it wasn't actually kill all vulnerable beginnings, but that's the way I've remembered it, that sometimes when I'm just beginning to have an idea about something, I just kill it because I think it's stupid, or I don't feel like it's clear enough. So as I thought further, I wanted to start with a parable familiar that to all of us. It's the parable of a grandparent talking with their grandchild, telling them that in life there are two wolves inside of us that are always at battle. Am I feeding back?
I think you are. So.
Okay, I don't.
I think that maybe everybody isn't muted.
Okay, could someone else mute everybody? And I'll unmute myself.
Everyone else is muted now.
Okay, thanks. So it's the parable of a grandparent talking with their grandchild, and the grandparent says, in life, there are two wolves inside of us and are always at battle. One's a good wolf, which represents actions of kindness and bravery, love, generosity. The other is a bad wolf, which represents things like greed and hatred and fear. And the grandchild looks clear-eyed at their grandparent and says, which one wins? And the grandparent says, the one you feed. So, as I was singing, Killing Me Softly with his words, and thinking about this parable, I thought about the ways in which I've likely killed people and killed relationships and done some killing of my own dreams. I've certainly killed time, unfortunately, in this life. But I do realize that with practice, so much a part of life at this point, that I am more careful. I try to be anyway. And when I'm not, it's more upsetting. When I say something or I hear something that comes out a little wrong or a lot wrong. And mostly, I guess I understand that it is part of this aging process as well, that, as Martha just said, there are times when I'm very surprised. Oh my gosh, said that. But with a kind of wish to look closer at the precept, I wanted to share with you a little bit about a story a friend of mine told me recently that sort of brought these two things into dialogue. She has a mother who's just turned 95 who needed to be moved this year to an assisted living center. And it's been really hard for her mother, but also for my friend and her brother and sister. Her mother's a not yet retired Jungian analyst at 95, with seeing 20 patients a week still. Doesn't want to go into assisted living, but is having a hard time doing some of the daily care for herself. And the children are wanting to convince her to move. My friend has a long history of conflict with her siblings about everything in their family. And she wants the mother to move, and the others don't. She's the oldest child, and she understands that she has a kind of compulsion to dominate the group at times. And when she was telling me about this week, because they had sort of a big meeting about it at Thanksgiving, she said, I just wanted to kill my sister and then my brother next in line. And we all might know this dynamic. I was thinking back how I was remembering how Jack Kornfield used to say in his Dharma talks, this is why they call them nuclear families. It was explosive when she told me how they began to yell at each other and that it became more and more heated because there was an urgency. A space had opened up in a place where they wanted the mother to move, where she wanted her mother to move. It was just perfect, she thought. So a lot of words started flying like arrows, some very sharp-tipped, with anxiety and loss of control and the need to be right and anything but not being wrong. So they were all struggling, afraid that something new was about to happen. That's the newness of, I think, affirming, a disciple of the Buddha protects life, protects those new vulnerable beginnings of life. And my friend, who is a longtime meditator, decided that she wanted to try and trust that beginning, beginner's mind, our precious practice, and to try and stay quiet and not shoot off her big mouth. and feel into the agitation and fear, but trying hard not to react and not to be the bossy older sister. So the family was having this difficult conversation without mom being there. And my friend told them, I'm going to try and stay quiet. That was part of the experiment. I thought it was pretty great. She said, I'm going to try not to say anything for a while. And I'm here, I'm listening, I'm part of the conversation, but I'm not going to intrude for a while. Why don't you guys talk about how you feel? So she said that she followed them with her eyes, and she felt that she was squarely sitting there with her body facing people, not turning away. And that as she became quieter, that she felt a certain kind of affirmation coming through her, an energy that she says was not usually something she could feel with her family. She felt alert. She felt like she was paying close attention to all of them. And then she said that she felt almost like a cooling energy in her face. Now, you know, this might be, of course, imagination playing a big part in this, but it was pretty interesting to hear her saying that she felt like it was an act of bearing witness to others. And then eventually, as she spoke up, she found herself saying something that surprised her. She started to talk about how much she knew they all loved their mother, and that she herself felt afraid for their mother's declining health and her possible imminent death. And it was a new way for her to see herself as maybe one who carried a space for understanding and peace in the family, something that was needed, that was usually missing. She really felt good. Her heart felt wise, and she was sure that her Dharma practice had really helped her. As she was reporting it to me, I copied down. She said, I realized by being gentle with myself, by telling them I was trying out this experiment with my own behavior, not getting frantic, bossy, dominant, that I was opening myself up to them. I was telling them my real feelings, not killing them. And it wasn't really so hard. So I thought, oh, thank you. You just gave me a wonderful chance to share that with the people in my Dharma group. I think all of us know that this is something about how we want to be. And when we stop and think about it, we know that killing others with sarcasm and criticism and, you know, sometimes, you know, those sort of not really funny little jokes, the things we do sometimes that try to show up people in a way that's sort of smart alecky, or deceiving them even through a kind of trickery. It's not who we really want to be. It's not the wolf we want to feed. But it's to understand that actually what we most deeply long for is who we are coming back to our own hearts, to our own beauty, to our whole being, Buddha nature. Knowing that that is with us always. That is not something we are trying to gain. It's the aliveness shining out of our face. That's, I think, what my friend started to feel. She felt it as a coolness, but I've felt it myself sometimes too, that when there is some kind of a connection, like Michael was just saying, that, you know, that truthful connection where we really know that it's our true selves there in the conversation has a real effect on our body and how we feel. in the conversation at that time. And we all know, excuse me, in our eyes, such a place of aliveness. Sorry. So for a moment, I wanted to ask all of us to look around. I'll silence myself and cough for a minute. To look around and to look at each other's faces. To really see the beauty in one another. Look into each other's eyes. Letting the face relax. Just letting ourselves be curious as we look at other people. Letting others see us. Letting ourselves feel a little vulnerable. Share our beauty. Knowing that we're always learning, no matter how old we get, how much zazen we do. Our strengths and our inner capacities can always be developed further. They can grow, we know that, and we talk about it, we respond to it and honor it in each other. We train in this presence and steadiness. We train in response to difficulty, not turning away, but just trying to meet others with equanimity, respect, allowing the joys and the sorrows to arise, met with dignity. And we tune in more and more, remembering that good wolf, remembering that there are capacities in ourselves, though they may be waning in some ways, they're making way for others, other capacities. We can feel the ease these days of giving things away, of caring for others, not killing or stealing time, not killing dreams. Perhaps apologizing or asking for forgiveness in relationships where we've done harm. And knowing that generally the wolf responds when we're tender and we nourish each other with kindness and tender petting. We know that there's something in our spiritual life that's not about gaining or changing ourselves, really. It's just owning the fact that we're really here and that we're really beautiful and that others are beautiful. And that in our good fortune, we get to live this human incarnation. And our job is to be fully present with 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. And not getting something where you finally feel you have enough. So this practice is not, we know, about perfecting ourselves. It's much more about perfecting our love. A love for this human life that we share with all life, remarkable life. Trusting, learning to trust ourselves. I really feel like that is something that only in these last few years have I begun to understand how important it is to trust myself and others, to feel our vulnerability, and to trust that we can share that with each other, not try to kill off our fear, our worry, our frailties. We're not trying to stave off all bad things happening. We can't. It's just part of the turning of the seasons of our lives as much as this moment of winter solstice occurs. It's just how it is. So I hope this doesn't stray too far from what we might have thought of as, you know, vowing to protect life and not kill. But I so often have said something I wish I could take back. And now I feel a little freer to either take it back or say, you know, I'd like to do it over. I'm sorry. I hope that all of us can find a way, as Ellen was saying, in the holidays that are coming, whether with family or we're with close friends, to just really be our vulnerable selves. We're told in Dharma talks all the time that we're not separate from anyone or anything else. And I really have gotten to a place now where maybe I should stop even saying bad wolf and good wolf. It sort of sets up that duality that makes that separation. You know, maybe it's we're all wolves. I'm sure. Maybe it's that we're all wolves and we're all birds and we're all bees and red-tailed hawks and whales and aging parents and sisters and brothers who we want to get along with better. Maybe we're just all of us bringing life-giving, protective words of Dharma, our hearts open, generous as our food and our medicine for this holiday season. Thank you all very much. Just unmute yourself when you're ready, Michael.
Thank you. I think I'm ready. Are we all ready?
Yes.
For part two?
Yes.
Thank you, Jean, very much. Your beautiful emotional talk. Really helpful to be pointed toward Buddha. Thank you. I wanted to say a few words before talking about the first grave precept, about the 10 grave precepts. And my way of doing that will be to read a little bit from Reb Anderson's introduction on the 10 grave precepts, because I think it helps to orient us toward the grave precepts and the precepts in general. And so I'll just read that paragraph, short paragraph. Reb says, the 10 grave precepts indicate a wholesome way of living that arises spontaneously from the ground of our Buddha nature. They are Buddha's wisdom in action and are the natural expression of a compassionate heart. Even though they read like prohibitions, the 10 precepts are not given to prevent us from acting in unwholesome ways, but rather are meant to awaken us from delusion. When our actions come from delusion, the violation of these precepts is a natural consequence. Therefore, their purpose is not to control or limit living beings in any way, but to encourage the fullest flowering of life. So this statement of Reb's points out, I think, that the precepts and our desire to live by them comes from our own deep-seated desire, innate central desire to wake up, to live by awakening. Suzuki Roshi called it our inmost desire. And more than desire, in addition to desire, I think it's our inmost need, which I think, like Jean was saying, we feel we need to practice this by this this way, by this desire inmost. I wanted to start my talk by kind of talking a little about the value of life in Buddhist, you know, in Buddhist teaching. Why is it that the first precept is not to kill life, but to support life, to nourish it? So I wanted to start with a little about from that point of view. And I had been thinking about an event that happened about 10 years ago when my younger brother died unexpectedly while taking an afternoon nap. He lived in Florida, and I was there a couple of days later for his funeral and woke up in the middle of the night and really felt myself. Maybe other people have had this type of experience, but probably. I felt myself really surrounded by dark, deep space, and really felt the briefness of my life. And I also felt that once this ever so brief spark of my life went out, I'd be gone forever in the infinity of time to come. And I was both terrified and at the same time cognizant that this felt like the simple truth. It might be terrifying, but it seemed to me at the time the simple truth of our lives that we face. And at the time I thought, it felt so important to me, the moment, that I thought, I have to remember this moment. I have to honor it. That word came to mind, honor the moment. And how does it call us? How does this kind of realization or feeling call us to live our lives? What's the intrinsic value of each of the moments of all of our lives in the face of infinity? And then the words on the wooden sounding board at Zen monasteries that many of us know came to mind. Inscribed on the sounding board, it says, "Great is the matter of birth and death. Know forever, gone, gone. Awake each one, don't waste your life." And just that, gone, gone, you know, and every beat, every moment of our lives is gone, gone. So how do we live in that reality? As an ER doctor, I saw many people suddenly find themselves unexpectedly in a hospital bed or on an emergency department gurney. I think of that and I think in moments of my life when I feel dull and distracted, which is not a small amount of time, I think that in the future sometime I'm going to find myself lying on a hospital bed or an ER gurney looking up at the ceiling. And when that time comes, I'm going to think back to the dull, distracted times in my life when I'm sitting on the living room couch or pulling out the garbage pails, and I'm going to want those moments back. I'm going to think of those moments as great and wonderful moments. What a gift. Shantideva, the Tibetan Buddhist teacher, tells us about the chances, the probability of being born into a human life is the same as the possibility, this is his analogy, of a blind turtle swimming around in the ocean, poking its head through an ox's yoke that's floating on the vast ocean. The chances of being born into a human body is the same as the chances of that occurring. His way of reminding us of the preciousness of our human lives. So the first grave precept is all about how we act in our lives, toward all living beings. All of life is rare and precious, and our human lives especially offer opportunities for spiritual growth, for the possibilities of cultivating lives of liberation for ourselves and others. Because we have the capacity for empathy, we recognize that other human beings and other beings also have very precious lives, and they want pretty much the same things that we do, exactly the same things we do. I listened to a talk by Gil Fronsdale, a teacher now in the Theravadan tradition, and he tells us that the Sanskrit word karuna, which translates as compassion, literally translates as a trembling of the heart. A trembling of the heart in synchronicity with the hearts of others, with the suffering of others. And similarly, we're capable of sympathetic joy, a trembling of our hearts in response to the joy or the happiness of other people and other beings. Our capacity for empathy or understanding of what we ourselves most want in our lives, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, you might say, as well as our practice of putting ourselves in each other's shoes, makes this first precept most important. And Gill calls it the fundamental precept or the cardinal precept. In the Theravadan tradition, it's the first, and it's the first for a reason. Gill related the story of the Greek king Melinda, who about 200 years before Christ met a Buddhist monk named Nagasena. The king wanted to learn about Buddhism from Nagasena, and Nagasena told him that the primary characteristic, the number one characteristic of Buddhism is non-harming. One might say that our practice is one of learning how not to cause harm to others and how not to cause harm to ourselves. From there, we go on to taking up opportunities to nurture life. So, what are some of the meanings of not to kill in our lives? The practice of Zazen and mindfulness allows us to examine all the areas in our life where we encounter issues of non-harming, non-killing, and sustaining life. And it doesn't take, I think, much more of a scratch on the surface to see the complexities. One of the first issues we often think about in relation to non-killing is what we eat. We may avoid killing or participating in the killing of animals by being vegetarians, but we shouldn't disregard the life of the plants we eat or the lives of the sentient creatures that are taken in the process of raising vegetables. Where do each of us decide to draw our line with respect to non-harming? That's what our practice is about. Where do we draw the lines for ourselves? We can't avoid killing something in order to nourish our bodies, and how do we live with that fact? Every year at Green Gulch Farm, Reb tells us There's a ceremony to recognize the intentional and unintentional killing that's part of farm activity. Reb quotes the ceremony in part as dedicated to, quote, the little sparrows and house finches who have died in the strawberry nets, numerous orange-bellied newts who died by our shears and by our feet, slugs and snails whom we have pursued, feeding you to the ducks, and on, a paying of respect to the lives of the many creatures that were sacrificed to feed the community. I think that, as Reb says, goes on to say, the key point here is not to close our hearts to the suffering caused by our need to eat. And indeed, the very closing of our hearts is a form of killing. How else, what other ways can we think of, do we know of, that we may close our hearts? For example, what ideas do we hold about other people that shut down our connections and kill life? What ideas might we have about who we think we are, which shut down our recognition of who we actually are, who we really are, and thereby impoverish us and the people close to us? Luckily, we have the practice of Zazen to keep our eyes and our hearts open, and we're very lucky to have that practice, those practices. In thinking about this precept, I realize that the precept does not give us any fixed rules about right or wrong ways to act. I remembered a patient who was brought to the emergency department with pneumonia by her family, 95 years old, with very prolonged and very profound dementia, bedridden and lovingly cared for by her daughters at home. They turned her regularly to avoid bed sores. She was amazingly clean. I still remember years later the shine and the softness of her skin, which they rubbed with lotion regularly. And they wanted everything medically possible to be done for her to extend her life, which is what we did. I also remember a very good old friend who was dying of end-stage bladder cancer in the hospice unit of a hospital on a morphine drip to control her pain. Since she was beyond asking for it herself, her husband had the job of interpreting the grimaces or the expression on her face to decide when she needed more pain medicine. And one afternoon, he looked at me and he said, "I think she's in a lot of pain, don't you?" And I didn't really see much change in her expression, but I knew that what he was asking was that her dose of morphine be increased so that the end of her life and suffering would be hastened. And it was not that hard for me to agree that, yes, I think she does seem to be in more pain. I agree. There's no black and white in our lives, it's only gray. I have good friends who had after their second child was born with spina bifida and other deformity, other impairments, decided to give her up for foster care rather than bring the life of that child into their family. If they had known of her condition in utero, I'm pretty sure they would have decided to terminate the pregnancy, but they didn't have that opportunity. I have other friends who raised the child with very similar problems until he was 20 years old or more. I don't remember exactly. Finally, the demands on them became too great, and they allowed him to be moved to a state facility where they thought he could get better care. And his mother, to this day, speaks of him as the greatest teacher she's ever had. raising him as the greatest teaching she's ever had. So this brings me back to our human predicament, being our little speck of consciousness in the vast universe, doing the best that we can to respect our lives and all forms of life. I came across this quote that I'll end with from Václav Havel. Never know how to pronounce his name. From Václav Havel, the former president of the Czech Republic. He said, "Our life on this earth is not just a random event among billions of other random cosmic events that will pass away without a trace. It is an integral component or link, however minuscule, in the great and mysterious order of being, an order in which everything has a place of its own, in which nothing that has once been done can be undone." So thank you very much for your attention. Thank you very much for practicing, for being here. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I ring the bell? Let's take a moment. Let Michael's words sink in. Shall we each give a question, Mike?
Why don't you start? Go ahead. Yes.
Well, it comes right from the wording of the precept. I'm going to put you in breakout groups for about 12 minutes, in which you'll have a chance to speak with another person. And, you know, remember, each person gets to speak without being interrupted for 4 minutes. And we don't interrupt, we don't crosstalk, we just listen. And then after you each have a turn, then you have 4 minutes to talk with each other. And I'm thinking, what are you protecting in this life? What are you not killing? That's my question. So let's see. I'm going to take Michael off spotlight. And then I'm going to put. Yes, Michael?
Well, I don't. I think that's a beautiful question. I don't really have a specific question, or just except for people to consider how this precept feels in their lives, how it acts, or what their relationship feels like to it. Something general. Go. Yeah. Sorry.
And if you end up in a room